Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. You've noticed we've changed the name to Alaska Edition. This reflects our expanded coverage of statewide issues, although we will continue to focus on important Anchorage issues as well. Our guests tonight are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and from Fairbanks, Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Paul, the legislative impasse continues. Where are we?
Well, as you point out, the impasse continues. We're in the towards the end of a special session, 30-day special session. I think we've made progress been made on the operating budget. Apparently, as we were being taped here for this, there was some word of it being approved by conference committee and that sort of thing. The capital budget is still very much up in the air. Nobody seems to be giving much ground in that regard. So we're pretty much hung up on the capital budget, and I believe that's probably where we'll be for at least a few more days.
Okay, Dermot, what's next?
Well, I think, Mike, as Paul says, the capital budget remains the big sticking point, with the operating budget more or less settled as of today. While there is going to be a continuing battle, though, for the next few days, over exactly how the energy projects that the Senate wants to lump together will be handled. And so this involves a sort of complicated three-way negotiation with the Senate, the House, and the governor. The special session is going to continue past this weekend, that's for sure. It may go to the end of the 30-day period that it was called for.
Okay, and
I imagine they're probably getting anxious to get out of there too.
Monday will mark the third week, right? The completion of the third week. Okay, Paul, where does this leave the governor?
Well, the governor. This is actually, I think, really between the House and the Senate. But the governor, I think, plays a pivotal role as the cajoler in chief, or the facilitator, or the bargain maker, or the guy who finally convinces Senator so and so or House member so-and-so to move. I don't think he can force anybody to do anything, but at this point, I think he's the grease in the wheels. He could actually get this thing to move if he worked on specific leadership in the House and the Senate. I think that he stands to win a lot if it pushes forward, and he also stands to have a real problem if the Senate's language remains in that bill.
Dermot, what kind of response do you hear from the voters, constituents, and Fairbanks?
Well, Mike, the people I've talked to are not very happy, and I'm not sure if it's directed, I can't say for sure it's directed just at the Senate. I believe it's directed at the legislature and the governor, and they're just sort of confused as to why this is taking so long. We have to sort of step back and look that all these decisions are being conducted, or the discussions are taking place in secret, and the decisions are largely being made in secret. And so we have, you know, reporters sort of picking around at the edges trying to discern what's going on. But this is a sort of result of the basically what amounts to a closed government system that we have now when it comes to determining the budget for the state of Alaska. And I think this is going to stick around for a while. People are going to be unhappy with how this is all played out.
Well, many columnists have pointed out that on any given day, you can find 25% of the people who don't like their government at all and wish the legislature would just jump on the Gastineau channel. But at the same time, there is concern about secrecy, but this has been going on for decades, right? Or versions of it.
Well, that's certainly true. Alaska has made a habit of conducting the really important budget decisions in the legislature in secret at the end. And I just think that I think it'd be not, you know, as a columnist, my point of view has been that this should be a wake-up call to Alaskans that perhaps we ought to insist on a process that allows a more open view of what exactly is going on. And I believe the governor has a key role to play in settling this thing, because the governor's in the most powerful position to really, you know, knock heads together, although I don't think that's really in Governor Parnell's nature, but really he's in a position in which he can sort of bring these people together and make a settlement.
Well, but also our Lyndon Johnson, when he was president, was considered one of the great head knockers of all time, but he was also good at let us reason together, getting people in a room and just saying, now, Bob, right, Dermot?
Right. Well, you're certainly right about that, Mike. And of course, we've had governors who were been able to do that too. So I really think that the way this has played out, we complete the entire regular session, in which there are many public hearings about some important things, but some things not so important. But then we come down to what's really the key thing for the state of Alaska, and that is the operating budget and the capital budget, and the decisions are all made out of public view. And that's just really not a good public process.
Okay, Paul Jenkins wants to get a word in here quickly.
I think Dermot makes a good point. The average guy on the street doesn't understand the difference between the capital budget and the operations budget and how all of that works. All he knows is we have a legislature that stayed for 90 days and did virtually nothing, and now is into a special session and has accomplished very little. And when they blame people, they're not blaming while they were mad at the House, they're mad at the legislature and they're mad at the governor. And that's something I think is lost on members of the legislature.
And frequently from time to time, the public will say, but my legislator is a good guy.
My guy's a good guy. You're
trying
stinks,
to do the best.
Right.
Okay, let's go on to Jill Burke and get her in here. Jill, welcome to the show. Sarah Palin is back in the news, if she ever left nationally. Mm-hmm. A group is raising funds for her, and it's kind of unusual. Tell us about this.
Well, this is just part of a story that we picked up on, and I think what is kind of the overall effort of people to get a sense of whether Governor Palin is actually going to run for president or not. I don't know that we know that at this point, but we're starting to see her support groups get more organized, develop websites, develop, you know, local state-based groups. And we ran across one in Nevada called Friends for Palin 2012. And what stood out about that particular group to us was that it lists as its president Sarah Palin, which is unusual. Generally, when groups form to support a candidate or a cause, they have their, you know, their organizers. It could be the three of us, and I might list Michael Carey as the president, I'd be the treasurer, Paul would be the, you know, operator or director. So that was, we wanted to know more about that. We checked into it, and through Sarah Pack learned that there's, you know, most likely Palin doesn't know anything about it. No one in the office had heard about it, and they were quite confident that if she was directly involved, they would know about it. And our efforts to track down the founders of this particular group got us nowhere. We finally reached one of them on the phone, who's a guy based in Texas, and he said, send us an email, and he never got back to us. So it's kind of this group with all these dead ends that clearly is set up to promote in some way, for some reason, Palin in 2012. But then we found a similar group by a same name, but we don't know if the Nevada-based group and this web-based group are one and the same, Friends for Palin 2012. But this other one is a web house designed, or is a website designed to take campaign contributions. And they're not small. They range in size from $5,000 to $100,000. And at the bottom is a blurb saying, you know, depending on what level of contributor you are, you may either get to participate with me on certain issues, or I think at one point it was meet with me directly. I can't believe, like,
may
an inner
I just
circle.
To interrupt you briefly.
Sure.
It seems incredibly amateurish that people would do this and not have, you know, that the Palin campaign would know nothing about it. Now, I realize they're not supposed to be in concert, but at least they should know about it. And the other thing is, where are you supposed to send the money? I'll bet it's to a mailbox somewhere, right?
It is, yes. And so the thing is, you know, what we don't know, what we wanted to answer is this really an independent group of well-wishers who are either trying to cash in on it or really want to support the governor in some way, and they're just doing their own thing? Or is some of this strategic collusion where you can remain an arm distance away, you get some things mobilized, like this groundswell, you know, beneath the surface, and when you're ready to make the announcement, you mobilize your network that's already in place. I don't think that that's what has happened in this case.
Well,
I
you're not alone here on trying to figure out who's doing what. New York Times had a wonderful story last year on a very similar kind of thing where they were doing an investigation, and they finally wound up getting a guy in Florida to answer the phone who then hung up.
Right.
And that's as far as they got, and the mailbox.
And I think this other co-directors may actually be based in Florida. We weren't able to identify it. Someone by the same name claims to be a former or current employee of Serapac. Serapac says, no, we've never worked with anybody by that name. So again, you're back to, is this a volunteer or a supporter or someone who's very energetic and enthusiastic? And it's really hard to tell right now.
Or even, is it somebody who would be pleased to have strangers send them money?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And this website looks very official, but only the donation page is the page that's active. Everything else either has yet to be built or yet to be activated. And when you try to find out who owns that website, you get to this business corporation that's designed to anonymize the owner. So that's a dead end. And it's just, you know, a lot of unknowns.
That has a postal box too, right?
Well, you know, we don't know why Nevada, why these particular founders. It's just odd.
Paul, you're not in Florida, so you're not responsible for this anymore, but what do you make of this?
Well, there's all kinds of things going on. She's hired a new foreign policy guy. She's doing other things. She has no campaign set up in Iowa, nothing. You got some guy, the LA Times puts it, crisscrossing the state with a laptop and a sunny disposition.
Right, so, again, a guy who seems very dialed in, knows
right.
who to talk
knows
to,
to,
is
talk
very
to.
Active,
right.
but
That's
is
right.
kind of his own entity, like a free agent.
There's money to be made in this. I can't believe she won't go, but it's just, you know, it's hard to tell.
Okay, Jill, let's move on to another subject. It's becoming a hearty perennial on this show, and that's the Fairbanks Militia story. What's the latest on Schaefer Cox and his allies, colleagues, and others who wound up in jail with him?
Right. Well, the five defendants who are currently in custody have their trials scheduled for about a year from now, I think. So everything has slowed down. The case has been declared complex. That's not particularly new. That happened a couple weeks ago. But what we've done that was new is track down one of the associates who was kind of involved with this group of people, rubbing elbows with them, who claims that he was good friends with what is believed to be one of the informants that worked with the government and was there at some of these events that the government clearly was monitoring, like this militia summit in Anchorage, and really felt like his former friend, Bill Fulton, who's the former owner of Drop Zone, which is a, gosh, how would you describe it? Supply store and ammunition store, military gear surplus store here in Anchorage. Who just dropped out of sight kind of under cover of night after signing over his home and his business to other people about a week after the arrests. So this gentleman from Fairbanks, who is identified in court records as the Fuse King, says that Fulton worked very, very hard to kind of bait him into getting into trouble, either providing fuses for grenades that some of these people are accused of trying to purchase to make the grenades active, and other incidents where he really felt like he was pushed hard to be in places where the federal investigators were monitoring and watching to try to get him to take some action that could then potentially lead to his arrest. And so he obviously not real happy with his former friend and associate, Bill Fulton.
Big emphasis on the word former.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah, my sense is that he's pretty unhappy, but it's hard to tell sometimes. You know, I don't know if they would ever be able to reconcile over this, but he was pretty hot. He felt like Fulton may not have recognized really what he was up to and the seriousness of it. And this is a guy who has young children and obviously a livelihood to protect and claims that he wasn't into anything illegal or doing anything wrong. But it was clear to him, in his opinion, that this was really just an operation to try to nail as many people as possible and create situations by which that could occur.
Okay. Dermot, for a couple of questions. One, you have anything to add or anything new in Fairbanks on the militia story?
Well, not really, Mike, except I just might point out that at the Bar Association convention here this week, there was a great deal more security than such events have had in the past. And I think that's due in part to this situation. There were no incidents that I know of, but the security was pretty visible with police dogs, at least one police dog.
Yeah, I've seen events at the Bar Association where they have when they have federal judges present. That is very, I couldn't even get in the room. I got thrown out. I mean, some people might think that's a good idea just generally, but that did happen. Dermot, air quality is back on the front page in Fairbanks. What form is the debate taking of what's become a hearty perennial?
Well, the issue here, Mike, is caused by two things. Oil prices, as you know, have risen dramatically. and diesel fuel, which is the major source of heat for most people in the Fairbanks area, have risen accordingly. It's well, you know, and the heating bills have skyrocketed. Fairbanks is located in a bowl, which there are hills around three sides of the town and sort of a flat valley out to the south. This bowl creates stagnant air in winter. So with this rise in oil prices, there's been a real increase in the number of people burning wood for heat in the winter. And outdoor wood boilers have become popular, and so is burning of coal. And this has led to a really visible increase in pollution on winter days when the air is stagnant, which happens a good deal of the time. I'm talking about on the valley floor. When you get up above from the hills, you can see the layer of pollution. Now, the latest thing is that there's another initiative put on the ballot that would limit the use of outdoor wood boilers, ban them in many cases, and stop people from burning coal. This is in the early stages yet. It is not on the ballot. The people supporting this, it's a group called Clean Air Fairbanks, have yet to acquire, they've just started acquiring the signatures they need to get on the ballot, and that will be on the ballot in October. It's the controversy is over where's the balance between clean air and paying and being able to heat homes in an affordable manner. And that's sort of an ongoing fight. It's lasted for the last few years, and I think it's gonna keep on going. We've had some bad problems in particular neighborhoods where people have been really smoked out, and that's really gonna give an impetus to this drive.
And that presumably causes trouble among neighbors. If you're the person who's the recipient of the bad air, and if you're the creator, you have very different views of things. Okay, Paul, let's
get
back to you.
That is certainly true, and the government's been real. That's okay, Mike. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Paul, BP pays a $25 million fine for oil spills on the North Slope. What's up?
In 2006, apparently because of lack of maintenance and oversight on their transit lines, they had a 5,000-barrel spill, largest in North Slope history, which netted them a $25 million fine as part of a consent agreement from a federal lawsuit. That's also one of the largest fines per barrel ever levied, I suppose. All in all, it has prompted a great deal of expenditures on the North Slope by the company. And other than that, their move ahead. So it's 5,000 barrels, 5,078 barrels got spilled from those transit lines. And like I said, it sparked lots of pipeline repair and maintenance on the North
and
Slope.
And the $25 million will put an end to these claims, charges.
That'll take care of it. It's done. There is a state lawsuit pending, and they're under federal criminal probation. So
okay,
we'll see how it goes.
Let's stick with you, Paul. The huge Goose Creek prison in the valley is not finished, and it's not going to be finished. Now, on the other hand, the builders from the valley are not going to be bailed out very much by the Alaska legislature, which gave them a bare-bones support of a couple million dollars.
Yeah,
I believe it's $2.5
million,
far less than they asked
2.4,
for.
Yeah.
What is to be done?
I don't know. You've got a $240 million prison sitting in the middle of nowhere with astronomical estimates for supplying utilities to
it. An unfinished prison.
It's an unfinished. It's only 80% complete. They said, well, give us $3.6 million, DOC said, and we can at least put 30 prisoners in there in the spring, and we'll pretend like this thing's up and running. The House said, okay, 3.6 for you, and the Senate went, no, nothing. So they got $2.4 million, which is not enough to do it. So here we sit with an 80% completed prison. We've got 1,000, it's a 1,500-bed prison. We've got 1,000 prisoners outside that we're paying for, $20 million a year. And if we get them up here, we'll be paying $70 million a year. So there's no real impetus to open this thing up, but it is an incredible white elephant just sitting there.
Do you have any theory on why building prisons has
such problems
with our political system?
I think everybody,
private prisons, our prisons, whatever it is.
I think everybody gets dollar signs in their eyes when they hear prison. You know, the unions like them if it's a state prison because it's jobs. Private industry likes it because, oh, we cut a corner here, we cut a corner there, we can make real money. This one is astounding in that they put it in a place that it's going to cost a fortune to heat it, light it, get people to it. It makes no sense. It makes no sense from day one. I don't know how it got out there.
I liked what Greg Erickson said on this show when we were talking about this quite some time ago. He said the legislature took the position We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Now we've come to the bridge. Jill, the American people have been responding to the death of Osama bin Laden. There have been demonstrations. There have been some very moving ceremonies, especially in New York City and Washington, D.C., where the airplane crashes took place. Do you think there's any different reaction among Alaskans concerning the number of veterans we have here, the number of people who, residents here, who are overseas at the present time serving? And to be frank about it, Barack Obama didn't do very well here in the election and isn't inherently popular here unlike some other states.
Right. This is an interesting question, and I was actually tossing this around with my colleagues earlier today before coming here. And I think that, you know, it's hard to say. One colleague, Craig Medred, said because we have more military, there may be more of a subdued reaction, meaning it's not that they're not overjoyed, they're not thankful, but that they understand the front lines of war, they understand what it means to kill, and they're not going to take that for granted regardless of who it may be. So that celebration may be a little bit over the top or distasteful perhaps, but that certainly this is a moment for elation in the sense that this is a huge and momentous event and a significant move forward in our the nation's fight to bring this to some kind of conclusion. Others said we're so far away from New York City where the attacks initially took place that we weren't so directly affected as some of those other larger cities, that distance itself may have caused us to not feel the need to hold a parade or to hold a rally or to get that many people together. Personally, I think that anytime you have a cause for nationalism and the nation to kind of rally against a common enemy, that itself divides or that cuts across party lines, although we're certainly seeing some political division in the way people are ascribing who really deserves credit for this event, whether it's the prior administration or the current administration.
About the photographs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, one party takes one point of view, the other takes the other.
So I don't know. I mean, you guys may have some altering opinions or be seeing different things, Dermot up in Fairbanks or Paul, but I don't know that it's necessarily overwhelmingly different because we're so heavily military.
Paul, any thoughts here before we turn to Dermot?
Well, I think, especially in Fairbanks, you still have people in harm's way, and I think it really does mute your celebratory feelings. I mean, I think they feel it. I think among themselves they probably celebrate in their own way, but I don't think you're going to see many public displays.
Okay, Dermot Cole, the Tanana ice went out on the Tanana River, and we have winners of the ice pool, several of whom are from Fairbanks. This is one of Alaska's most traditional events, and in some ways historically has defined the country. Give us the history, and do I understand it that now you can look at the ice breaking up on YouTube?
There were 22 winners this year when the ice went out. Now again, this started in 1917 with workers on the Alaska Railroad, basically betting on when the ice would go out. And that was important at that time because that's when river traffic could resume. So people paid a great deal of attention to all of the rivers at that time because they expected to get new mail and new food and new supplies from the outside. Anyway, this grew up into the Nenan Ice Classic, which, by the way, was illegal up until statehood. And there was a big fight in the first legislature to legalize the Ice Classic, and over the objections of Bill Egan, the legislature did legalize it. The at one time there was a great deal of money. Well, still it's nothing to show disrespect to. The winners are going to split over $300,000. But back in the 40s and 50s, if you adjust for inflation, the winners would get close to $1 million in today's money. So the people, particularly in this area, pay quite a bit of attention to the ice at Nenana. And it usually goes out about a week after the Nenana River goes out, which is just downstream from the town of Nenana. And that's basically what happened this year when it went out Wednesday afternoon at 4:24 standard time. It's worth noting that the ice class, and by the way, yes, I use a standard through YouTube, which I put a link on my blog at the Newsminer site, that shows the 5 minutes preceding the tripod going out. And I don't know in the past that we've ever had such good coverage. This was by a reader in Nenana who submitted this, and it's really pretty entertaining to watch it. It's not like exactly watching a NASCAR race, but it is interesting to see the tripod slowly moving away from the shore.
And I would, yes, I would say that having played this for many years, this is the first year I've ever gotten my head a ticket on the same day. We're out of time here on Alaska Edition. We want to thank Dermot Cole and Fairbanks for joining us. Also Jill Burke and Paul Jenkins here in our studio in Anchorage. I'll be in Fairbanks next week, but Alaska Edition will return.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.